This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. The BFM Breakfast Grill. Top interviews you can't afford to miss. Presented by the CIMB Group.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin, and on the Breakfast Grill with me today is Professor Dato Wu Wing Tai, the former Executive Director of the Penang Institute, Director of the East Asia Program of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, and a fellow at Brookings Institute. He's also recently become the president of the newly established Jeffrey Chia Institute on Southeast Asia. Welcome to BFM.
Wonderful to be here.
Professor, I want to begin with a quote from John Kenneth Galbraith, and he says, "In economics, hope and faith coexist with great scientific pretension and also a deep desire for respectability." I think it's a tongue-in-cheek remark, but it does surface the question about the commitments that economists have in terms of values, in terms of ideology. And perhaps to set the stage, you could say something about your ideas about the state, the market, individuals, community equity, and related issues. Where do you stand on those questions?
Oh, I think it is quite clear that for society to progress, you need to have immense collaboration between the state and society. The state to coordinate actions that will ensure that the greater public good is observed. For example, the eradication of poverty and greater equality within the borders of the state. On the other hand, giving so much power to the government. History shows that the outcome of absolute power is absolute corruption. So it is very important that society is able to monitor and actively supervise the working of the state, not on a day-to-day basis, but on periodic examinations, like during a time of elections. So it is very good that the founders of this country started off with a democratic system, which allowed the people to assess the government every 5 years at least. So we have got the right institutional arrangement. Having said that, it doesn't mean that the existing arrangements are perfect, because arrangements are improved as technological ability goes up. Nowadays, with the internet, monitoring of government is easier. And people having increase in education level, people wish to feedback to the government right away. So there has to be good coordination between the two. And the government has to accept the fact that it's ultimately the servant of the people.
Now, you say we had a good start. Was that good start derailed in 1969?
The good start was not derailed in 1969. We realized that we need a cost correction. The free market on its own was not going to be able to address the needs of the majority of the country in a short enough time that is politically acceptable. That is why when the government formulated the NEP, they make two promises. One is elimination of poverty regardless of race, and a race-based restructuring of the economy, especially on the ownership. And given the cost of what happened in 1969, the emphasis was on the second component, which is the restructuring of the economy on race criteria. And the founders in 1970 were very conscious. These are emergency room procedures. We want to achieve that before negative consequences appear in the long run. That's why they write in an expiration clause. In 1990, we have to re-examine the situation.
That model for restructuring remains. It's with different names and different guises. Do you think that the solutions set up in the 70s still apply today and for our particular economic problems and in a changed global scenario?
The policy stopped working in 1994, before the Asian financial crisis. The policies were no longer capable of taking us to the next level, which is to a knowledge-based economy. The reason why the economic growth has been much slower than envisaged in 2001 after the Asia financial crisis, Dr. Mahathir envisaged the economy growing at 7.5% each year for the next 10 years. And what's the outcome? We grew at less than 4.5% a year from 2001 to 2010. The reason is the NEP policy framework is no longer compatible with the progress of the economy because of two things. One, changes within the economic structure itself. In other words, the very success of NEP should lead to its abandonment in order to move to the next stage. And the second big change that we are still seeing is a change in the global economy. I'd like to say on start with how the change in the global economy has harmed us. In 1970, when we started the policies of restructuring of the economy on race grounds, that led to the beginning of more capital flights out of the country. Like, for example, the Shangri-La Group is no longer a Malaysia-listed company. It is now listed in Hong Kong for the reason of trying to escape that 30% quota. The second thing was you see an increase in brain drain. Many people say brain drain is the result of higher salaries abroad, so that's the pull factor. Because there's a pull factor, we don't need to add a push factor to it. But the important thing is, one would have thought that given the flow of financial capital outwards, the flow of human capital outwards, growth was not possible. But the opposite happened. Growth actually jumped and went on for like a 7% a year. Why was that possible in a country where money was running out and people were beginning to run out? The reason is because globalization came in the form of relocation of production to Southeast Asia. Labor's gotten too expensive in the rich countries, and we, in 1970, led by Penang, under its attraction of the IT industry, we were the country alone, other than Singapore, to welcome foreign direct investment, having free ourselves from political colonialism. We were not afraid of economic colonialism. This is well against the economic thinking of that time. The economic thinking of that time is you got rid of them politically, now shut off your economic ties with them. We took with full confidence, we attracted them to come. So the important thing is think of a bathtub. Water is leaking out in terms of capital flight and brain drain. But FDI is bringing in foreign capital, bringing in foreign technology, bringing in foreign engineers. So the bathtub, the inflow was so big that it more than make up for the outflow. So the bathtub level rose and economy boomed. And we were very confident. And more importantly, we also found oil. Because we found oil, the government is able to undertake a lot of infrastructure investment to be compatible with the growth from the FDI. Because the FDI came in, the domestic industries were able to supply them inputs to replace their more expensive inputs. So that was the good times. But the world changed.
How does the lessons of the 1970s should shape the way in which we think about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement that's very controversial in Malaysia, because there's a lot of talk about sovereignty, about the loss of sovereignty. How would you use that experience of the 70s to kind of inform this present debate?
On the question of TPP, in any kind of negotiations, it can only go forward if there's a win-win solution. And sometimes the win-win solution may take the form of some pretty significant short-run cost, but over time, when the benefits appear and grow, then if you take into account the welfare of one's children, not only of one's the welfare of his own generation, then you could see that many of these deals are worth it. TPP will be amended to be in line with Malaysian priorities, because the Americans are very eager to enter into a deal with us to pronounce a success for Obama's forthcoming visit. So given their desire to come to a deal quickly, we hold the upper hand. So I think we can, with many of the serious concerns that have been raised, the Americans are likely to make significant concessions.
I'm speaking to Professor Dato Wu Wing Tai. He is the former executive director of Penang Institute and also the president of the newly established Jeffrey Chia Institute. After this, we come back with more on the middle income trap and how Malaysia can move forward in terms of dealing with a globalized economy.
Business-focused moments. BFM 89.9.
Good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin. If you just joined us, I'm speaking to Professor Wu Wing Tai. He is the president of the Jeffrey Chia Institute that's been newly established. Now, Professor, you were speaking earlier about the kind of attitude that Malaysia had in the 70s towards the global economy opportunities that came up. Now, what's changed? Do you think, in terms of the administration, in terms of the stakeholders in Malaysia, that our openness to the global economy has shifted?
What we have not done is to have taken advantage of the changes in the global economy to transform ourselves to be making new products that are much more valuable. Our strategy has been we grow by doing more of the same. Instead of we grow by making different things that are much more valuable to us. Let me elaborate. The world changed on Malaysia on a night in May 2000 when China finalized its negotiations with the US to join WTO. Why was WTO important to China? For China, it would have meant economic restructuring that are much more painful than what people talk about, what TPP would do to Malaysia. China would have to lay off a lot of workers, but it sees the creation of new opportunities. But why is it important for us? Before China is a member of WTO, every year, US Congress has to pass what is known as the Most Favored Nation Clause to give Chinese goods the same treatment of entering US markets as goods from Malaysia and other parts of the world. So at any point in time, the United States could stop imports from China without violating international rule because China was not a member of WTO. And that would have killed the Chinese economy right dead in its track. And this almost happened several times during unhappy incidents in US-China relationship. Like, for example, when a Chinese pilot played what is called hot dog with an American spy plane, there was a collision and the spy plane went down. And the U.S. Congress came very close to not giving China MFN status in that year, which meant the economic growth would have stopped pretty much dead in its tracks. So this is a potential blackmail the Chinese could never accept. So when the Chinese were willing to pay the price, sign the WTO agreement, every American producer realizes that China now has guaranteed access to the U.S. and Western European markets. Labor is cheaper in China than in Malaysia. So, in the old days before WTO, when you built a clothing factory in China, you built one outside of China so that in case you cannot ship from China, you can ship from somewhere else. So once China had guaranteed access, our share of global FDI just plummeted beginning 2001. So I had been talking about the analogy of how to think about the economy after 1970. A bathtub with water. Water is leaking out because of capital flight and brain drain pushed by the race-based policies. And what has been keeping the bathtub full was FDI. So once the FDI stops coming in, our growth fell. You can see it. In 1994, Malaysian standard of living was 30% of US level in 1994. Today, it is still 30% of US level. Basically, we have not closed the gap between us and the US for the last 20 years. Compare that with the 20 years before 1994. We had gone from roughly 17-18% of US living standard up to 30%. When we hit that, and that coincided very well with the rise of China, the diversion of FDI away from China. And so how do we try to respond to it? Instead of producing more high-value added goods, more specialized goods that China still cannot compete with us, we just bring in cheap labor to try to meet the low cost in China. That is not a viable strategy. That cannot work. And it has not worked.
With regard to China, what should Malaysia be thinking about? China is a rising giant. We are part of a chain of production with Chinese companies. How do we think about best maximizing that relationship that we have with China?
Clearly, we must be changing ourselves so that we can sell to the Chinese the high value added components they need in order to assemble the product together for the final export market. So just think of the iPhone. Every iPhone leaves only $5 behind in China in terms of what labor gets, because most of the components of iPhone, the expensive parts, are all imported. So Malaysia, given our head start in a manufacturing, and especially in the IT industry, we should be moving up the value-added ladder so that we will make the high-value components to be shipped to China. The trouble is we do not have enough high-quality technical skills, and the absence of that has to do with the brain drain that we've been experiencing. The World Bank study shows 20% of the people who go to Malaysian universities migrate out of Malaysia, and most of them go to Singapore. So clearly these people like to be home. If they have to leave, where do they go to? They go to a place that's most like home and close to home. So I think that we can easily have these folks stay here. And because Malaysia, we have achieved the main goals of NEP. We have produced a dynamic, confident, innovative Malay middle class. What we need now is to mobilize the country fully across the races for national development. The middle income threat for us comes from failure to mobilize the entire country for the mission of national development.
Is the failure then essentially a political one? And what would change? Do we need political change at the federal level in order to institute a new direction for the country in terms of the economy and also all the other things that are complement to that?
Economists believe that well-regulated competition is the best mechanism to ensure progress. And what we are seeing is a self-correction happening in Malaysia. The lower economic growth in Malaysia has meant that the government now has less political patronage power to buy off people who object to its policies and be able to apply Band-Aid on a temporary basis. So the slower economic growth is what has been causing the unraveling of the usual politics in Malaysia. And this is self-correcting, because UMNO itself has clearly, if you look at the array of views within UMNO, many people see what is should be the next step. The next step is inclusive national mobilization. And how could UMNO be pushed further into transforming itself towards an inclusive national mobilization agenda? And I think it's because if it doesn't do it, the people that would replace them would do it. So co-opt the program of your competitor and tell them, you see, we will give you as good an outcome as the other side could give you without the possibility of some learning cost on the other side. But in this particular situation, the other side also having had control of several state governments, they have accumulated now critical mass ability to be able to run things pretty smoothly. So the competition between these two groups is good for us. So I really don't care who wins. What I want them to do is to enact the program of inclusive national mobilization for common prosperity. And JCI is very, very happy to be able to contribute to the thinking on both sides of the political divide. We would be glad if they all come up with the same common program, of course, with differences in details, that is inevitable. But the broad direction has been the same, inclusive national mobilization.
Thank you very much. I was speaking to Professor Dato' Wu Wing Tai, former director of the Penang Institute and now president of the newly established Jeffrey Chia Institute on Southeast Asia. Thank you so much for being with us. You've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Sharad Kutan on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.